All right, we have arrived at chapter 5, verse 2. And there is a typo there under after multiple inclusion. I apologize for that. That should be 5:2 through 7:10. And you will notice that we are back to the night motif in the larger outline of the overall chiasm, the C and C prime section of the poem. And that's clear in verse 2 of chapter 5, I was asleep, but my heart was awake. Now, as we begin our analysis of this section, which extends all the way to verse 10 of chapter 7, we notice that there is an inclusio between verses 2 and 8, where she says, my beloved, I was asleep, my beloved was knocking. So the form I and followed by my beloved in verse 2 is matched by verse 8. I and the phrase my beloved again in verse 8. Actually, it's in reverse form. It's a chiastic pattern. I and my beloved and I. This is an initiative response sequence, by which I mean it's a call or and answer sequence. For the beloved, which is the male figure, is approaching in verses 2 and 3, only to be rebuffed by the female figure. And he reacts in verses 4 to 6 by withdrawing from the scene. So, in verses 2 and 3, she's obviously in bed and ready for sleep, and he approaches, and she rebuffs him by asking if she has to get up and take care of him. And when she finally does, and he stirs her feelings, verse 5, then she finds out that, verse 6, he has turned and gone away. This is parallel to the tension in the night scene in chapter 3, verses 1 to 5. There we had that uneasiness or insecurity leading on to her to a search of the city as well as the house. But here we have an exacerbation of that tension. Here we have an actual rejection. So on the other side of the wedding night, on the, shall we say, honeymoon is over side of the wedding night, here is a scene in which conflict and rejection are prominent. There is an interruption in the harmony of their relationship to the point of a kind of apathetic indifference. And the question that this section will raise is the same question that the parallel section in chapter 3, 1 to 5 raised. Will the frenzy to overcome the estrangement, will it lead to reconciliation? So there's an element of suspense once again in this nighttime scene in chapter 5. Now I will return to this, but I want you to notice that in his withdrawal, in his turning and leaving, he does not push his way upon her indifference and apathy. He waits for it to take care of itself, or the hope that it will take care of itself. He is, in this respect, the exercise of wisdom, something we would expect from Solomon. So chapter 5, 2-8 is a self-defined unit because of the inclusio, the chiastic inclusio. That brings us to the next section of the unit, verses 9 to chapter 6, verse 3, 5:9-6:3, in which we have another physical description from verses 10 to 16, another wasp. And a wasp which is delineated by an inclusio. The term, my beloved, in verse 10 and in verse 16, bracket this section of the narrative. Now you will also notice that that wasp, that physical description between 10 and 16, which has its own inclusio, is set off by two sets of questions. Notice verse 9 and verse 1 of chapter 6. Verse 9, what kind of beloved and what kind of beloved? Duplicate question that sets off the beginning of this second physical description. And at the end of that physical description, chapter 6, verse 1, again, a duplicate question. Where has your beloved gone? Where has your beloved turned? So that I put together chapter 5, verse 9 through chapter 6, verse 3, because of the enclosed physical description and the sets of questions that even delimit that. Now notice one more thing. With the questions in 5, 9, and 6, 1, we actually have a question-answer sequence. What kind of a beloved is your beloved? Answer, my beloved is. 5:10. This physical description is her description then of him. He had described her on the wedding day. She is describing him after he's turned and withdrawn. Now the resolution of this series of questions is chapter 6, verses 2 and 3. My beloved has gone down to his garden. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. There is that perfect chiasm that I pointed out last night in 6:3, concluding this section in which she attempts to find the resolution for the estrangement of her apathy and indifference which has driven him away. The resolution occurs then in 6, 2, and 3 where there is a perfect chiastic mutuality. I am my beloved's and my beloved is mine. The deepening of their love flows out of the reconciliation after the estrangement. So they are back together in 6, 2, and 3. Now, after that reconciliation, after they are back together, 6, 4 to 10, he extols her, and he quotes those who extol her. So, you are as beautiful as Tirsa, my darling. Remember that that phrase, my darling, is his language. And what occurs in verse 4 there also occurs in verse 10. Beautiful, as awesome as an army with banners. Verse 10, beautiful, as awesome as an army with banners. So his response to her reconciliation is to describe how he is delighted with that reconciliation. He praises her in the light of that reconciliation. He describes her as beautiful, beautiful and awesome, and concludes in verse 13 with a quadruple, come back, come back, come back, come back. In other words, he himself is confessing or acknowledging the reconciliation of the estrangement. He is urging her to return her affections to him even as he had withdrawn his affections temporarily from her. Those are all imperatives. Come back, come back, come back, come back. They are urgent imperatives. And in 7:1-9, he compliments her again. The physical description, the next wasp, where she is beautiful. How beautiful, 7:1. Notice 7:6. How beautiful, another inclusio which binds together the unitary significance of this compliment. On the other side of the wedding night then, after the honeymoon is over, the proclivity to presumption, the proclivity to presume upon the relationship which has already been established, and the possibility of alienation, frustration, and isolation. But in this song, that presumption and self-centered apathy or indifference, which produces the wise withdrawal of the male figure, let her cool off, results in a reconciliation, a reunion, a resolution, a togetherness, a mutual praise, so that you know that this has been healed by the time you come to the end of this unit. Now notice, once again, on your outline, the pattern of multiple inclusio, which I have described in my kind of narration here, but the inclusios are so telescoping, so multiform here. The inclusios are here because of what's happening in the relationship. The inclusios which are bringing them together, bracketing them, are the emphatic point, structural point of this section, so that you are forced to think of them in tandem. The very structure of the Hebrew, the structure of the drama, the structure of their interaction won't allow them to think or to relate in isolation. They can't stay apart. The structure of the Hebrew brackets them. They must see themselves reciprocally, even in the face of apathetic isolation and temporary indifference. So that on your outline, for the first chiastic inclusio, you should fill in the blanks, I and my beloved at 5:2, at 5:8, my beloved and I in 5:8. In the framed inclusio, what I mean by that is that's an inclusio framed by an inclusio. Makes it doubly emphatic. 5:9, what kind, times 2. 6:1, where has, times 2. And in between 5:10, my beloved, 5:16, my beloved. And then the last two, Inclusio 6:4, beautiful as awesome as an army with banners. 6:10, beautiful, awesome as an army with banners. And 7:1, how beautiful. And 7:6, how beautiful. I want you to remember that when the estrangement comes into a marriage and the sense of distancing becomes withdrawal and even the feeling of rejection, that in this book you are given an insight in how that is healed. It is healed by the exercise of wisdom and patience, and at the same time the exercise of praise and delight and the adoration of the personality and the affection of the opposite party. Remember that it does virtually no one any good to fly off the handle in an intimate marriage relationship. It takes a lot longer to heal those ragged edges. The course of wisdom is when one party's dander is up, it's time to cool it and go out to the study or go for a walk or do something else until wisdom says we can get back together. Here is a patient husband dealing with a self-centered wife. But it can be just the reverse as well. And so the point is, even as Christ himself indulges a great deal of self-centeredness in his bride, who was it, Sir William Temple, that said the church was the bride of Christ, the leprous bride of Christ. She is still filled with lots of pustering sores. But how tenderly Christ patiently deals with her. And so you know that in your own relationship with the Lord Jesus, when you have often withdrawn or driven him away in your own indifference and apathy, how he has waited upon you by the quiet breathing of his Spirit until you have been wooed back into that inner sanctuary of love and delight in him. So it is here. It is here in a book which is part of the Chokmah, the wisdom of the Lord. The next unit is chapter 7, verses 11 through 8:4. And this unit matches up with the B section at the top of the chiasm, chapter 2, verses 8 to 17, because it is another invitation section. Verse 11, come, my beloved, let us go out into the country. It is an invitation to the countryside, even as 2, 8 to 17 was an invitation to the countryside. Now, will you notice that this is a response to his physical description of her in chapter 7, verses 1 to 5. He addresses her in verse 11 as his beloved, and in verse 13, it is the same term of endearment which dominated chapter 2, verses 8 to 17. And in chapter 2, when we look at who invited whom, and in chapter 7, 11 to 8, 4, when we look at who invited whom, we find again the chiastic reversal. For in chapter 2, he invites her, and in chapter 7, she invites him. I am my beloved's, and his desire is for me. Come, my beloved, let us go out into the country, and there I will give you my love, which I have saved up for you. Verse 13. Notice how she describes it as the mandrakes. Mandrakes which give forth their fragrance in a new and old way. What is she saying after the scene, the second night scene of apathy, when he withdrew in rejection? She is saying, I have new treasures of love for you. Come with me to the country. There is nothing in this relationship which is stale. There is nothing in this relationship which has become routine or humdrum. There is nothing in this relationship which has become mechanical. She has treasures new and old which she has saved up for him and which she delights to lavish upon him. It has been said that like a good wine, a good marriage gets better with age. That is what she's saying. She's saying, I have new delights for you. And so the freshness and vitality of this relationship is described in her response, her mirror response to take him to the country. So that as we saw those participles in chapter 2, verse 8 and 9, coming, leaping, climbing, here in chapter 7, verses 11 and 12, we have cohortatives, as they're called. Let us go, let us spend, let us ride, let us see. She's mirroring the kind of urgency of language that he used in chapter 2, verses 8 and 9. And once again, as it was in chapter 2 in that invitation to the countryside, here in chapter 7, it is an invitation to the countryside in the context of a springtime new creation. Look at the flowers and the vines and the fruits that are in bloom in this section. Let us go to the vineyards. Verse 12. Let us see the blossoms that have opened. See the pomegranates. Look at the mandrakes. Smell the fresh springtime air. These are the same vines and fruits. These are the same vines and fruits, vineyards and fragrances which appeared in chapter 2, once again cementing the parallel between the B and B prime sections of the poem. Vineyard, in verse 12 of chapter 7, is exactly the same word for vineyard in verse 15 of chapter 2. Vine in verse 12 of chapter 7 is exactly the same word for vine in verse 13 of chapter 2. Blossoms in verse 12 of chapter 7 is exactly the same Hebrew word for blossoms in chapter 2 verse 13. And fragrance in chapter 7, verse 13, is exactly the same Hebrew word for fragrance in chapter 2, verse 13. I can't make it any clearer because the Hebrew text itself makes it absolutely clear. These two parts of the story, of the poem, are integrally related by relationship of chiastic mirror. They are a parallel reflection of one another. And yet, though the scenes are parallel, and though the imagery is parallel, there is a difference. There is a difference between the garden springtime scene in chapter 2 and the garden springtime scene in chapter 7. In chapter 2, verse 12, the vines are being pruned. That happens early in the spring. But in chapter 7, verse 12, the vines are budding. What's happened between 2 and 7:12? Maturity. Maturity. That's what's happened. Notice again, the vine blossoms which have opened in chapter 7, the pomegranates which have bloomed in chapter 7 are the images of a maturing plant, the fruit coming to its maturity. The imagery then which compares the B and B prime section is the imagery that advances from love awakening in the spring, chapter 2, to love maturing and ripening in the spring, chapter 7. On the other side of the wedding night, their love is maturing. They are growing up. They are ripening in their affection for one another, even as the world, as they perceive it, in its springtime exuberance, is ripening as they behold it. Now this theme of maturing, ripening love, is explicit there in verses 12 and 13. The imagery of scent and blossom and a newborn world is the imagery which provides the background for her offer to give her love to him. Her desire to yield herself to him is accompanied with her declaration that new and old treasures of her love have been saved for him. New and old treasures of her love have been saved for him. Here's this image of exclusivity again. It's not a locked garden. It's not a curtained couch, but it's herself. It's herself as an exclusive possession of her beloved. That exclusivity is yielded with fresh ardor. Her lovemaking has new surprises. They are growing mutually in their experience and celebration of that exuberant delight. Now when we come to chapter 8, verse 1, in the middle of this section, commentators are befuddled by why she talks about her mother and wanting to be kissed by him out of doors. Some commentators have suggested that she views him like a brother, as she uses the simile in the first part of the verse, and is appealing for a kind of sibling relationship with her lover. That simply does not make any sense in the context of the whole book. And therefore, I throw it away. It's nonsense. Well, what is she asking for if she is suggesting that she wishes he were like a brother to her, whom when she found she would kiss out of doors? Well, popularly we call this PDA, public display of affection. And although I'm a little bit put off by that in the high school hallways that I observe around the country these days, because that's not PDA, that's PDM, public display of mauling. Nonetheless, the display of affection in public between husband and wife is not a great sin, and here she is saying that she is open to that. I want you to show your ownership of me in public as if you were like my brother. For my brothers would display ownership of me when we were in public. We used to move as a group. And even when we were children, we would hold hands as we moved in a group. And so I believe that what is behind this is an appeal for him to show outward public ownership of her by holding her hand, putting his arm around her, giving her a light kiss, whatever. She wants everybody else to see what he wanted everybody else to see when he brought her up to Jerusalem for the wedding day. She wants people to see, I am his. I belong to him. Look, he's put his mark of affection upon me in the public arena. And so, her exuberance isn't stopped by being out in public. A spontaneous expression or communication of his affection for her, even in the public arena, is something that she delights in. Now you will notice that this exuberance with which she responds is underscored by a number of verbs in verses 1 and 2. I found you. I would kiss you. Verse 2. I would lead you. I would bring you. I would give you drink. Let his left hand be under my head and his right hand embrace. Now notice that. You see what's happening? Those verbs are a crescendo oriented towards the supreme act of intimacy, verse 3, that his left hand were under my head and his right hand would embrace me. The only fitting conclusion then of moving from that public display of affection outwardly to her, bringing her to himself, leading him to herself, giving him drink from herself, is the consummation of 8:3. In both the wilderness invitation sections of the poem B and B prime, the awakening of love in 2:8-17 is followed by the refrain 2:6-7, let his left hand be under my head. And the ripening of love, the maturing of love, the coming of love to its most intimate, mature, confident, secure dimension is followed by the refrain, let his left hand be under my head. And one other point. I adjure you, 2:7. I adjure you, 8:4. In each of these sections, then, there is this reciprocal character of their love. But now, as we move towards the end of the poem, out of the wedding night, this reciprocal character is maturing. This love is deepening and ripening. And that brings us to the epilogue. What more could you say? What more could you say at the end of this maturing love relationship? Well, you could say something profoundly, profoundly cosmic. You could say something profoundly, profoundly mysterious. You could say that love is as strong as death, and that its flames are the flames of Yahweh, and that the waters of chaos cannot destroy it. You could say at the end of your song of love, your supreme song of love, you could say at the end that there is a mystery about the love of a man for a woman that takes it to a cosmic level. Because the images of verses 6 and 7 of chapter 8 are cosmic images. They are the images of the cosmic antithesis between death and life. They are the images of the fire of God. They are the images of the waters of the great deep. They are the images that suggest that something so deep and rich and flaming and passionate and powerful is involved in this love between a Christian man and a Christian woman that it touches upon the mystery of the cosmos. I could never, in 40 conferences, exhaust the meaning of verses 6 and 7 of chapter 8 of this poem, because I could only begin to scratch the surface of the depths of love itself as it has come from the hands of the great lover God Himself, who made the cosmos. I am therefore reminding you that in the bonds of love that you husbands and wives share, you are being brought in a glimpse into the cosmic understanding of the mystery of God's strong, flaming, powerful, unquenchable love for His bride. And at the end of the cosmos, you will stand on the other side of that eschatological wedding. And you will be able to say with the bride of Solomon, it was stronger than death. Its flame was the flame of God. And no waters of the deep could drown it. No, never. The epilogue of this poem is a staccato exclamation point upon Ephesians 5, where Paul says, I am speaking of the mystery, the cosmic mystery of Christ and His church. Here, in the depths of this Old Testament language, with all of its ramifications for Genesis 1, Isaiah 42, and other passages of the whole Old Testament canon, here in the Song of Solomon chapter 8, you are coming to the mystery of Solomon's bride. And as you walk away from this book, hurry, my beloved. Be like a gazelle a young stag on the mountains is like, hurry! So, your eager yearning is for that love itself to hurry and to be sweetly experienced in the marriage supper of the Lamb, where you will not be just invited. You will be the bride. The structures of the end of the Song of Solomon are parallel to the structures of the beginning. The beginning is as the end. The prologue is as the epilogue. The epilogue is as the prologue. You have vocabulary at the beginning and end of this poem which does not occur anywhere else in the poem. It therefore justifies the designation of 8:5-14 as a parallel A prime reflection of A, the prologue. And the inclusio of beloved, verse 5, and beloved in verse 14, is the final binding inclusio of the poem. We have journeyed poetically through love stronger than death or Sheol, the grave. There is a love in the history of redemption which was stronger than death and the history of the grave. And that love incarnate is at the marriage supper right now. And you who have been joined to that risen love have an open invitation to that wedding banquet. May your love be an anticipation of that eschatological consummation. Do you have any questions about the end of the poem? Perhaps taking it a step too far, just a slight step too far. The question was, is her invitation for him to come in chapter 2 or chapter 8, is that a reflection of the "even so, Lord Jesus, come quickly," the Maranatha request? No, her invitation here is an invitation for that sexual consummation and reconciliation. I don't want to push that too far on the other side there for the Maranatha image. That's a consummation image of wrapping up the end of the age. They do that in chapter 3. They do not do that in chapter 5. You will notice that in chapter 5, verse 7, the watchmen have a negative role. They catch her and they strike her. Now, what's happening there is, you see, that protecting or guardian motif is not effective because she's in the role of apathy, indifference, and alienation. So it's as if she is projecting or mirroring onto the guardsman or the watchman what she's experienced or feeling in herself. She feels that the relationship has been wounded or bruised, and she is, you know, she's cut off from it. So now she's got to kind of struggle through what would have been the guardian of the love in order to reconcile and resolve it. So the reverse image of the watchman in 3:1-5 and here in 5:7 is significant of the reversal in her own dramatic context. She is now responding or reacting, not in the frenzy of pursuit as she was in 3,
But now, in the frantic sense of being battered or being isolated and being left alone and trying to fight back through that. Yes, the question is in 8:1 the language of brother or a sibling affection in public more common than it is in our culture? Yes, it was. Still is in Arabic circles. You'll see a lot of affection between siblings even in public venues. That's one of the reasons I suggest this. I'm not dogmatic about that interpretation. It's just that the commentators are thrown by it. They come up with all kinds of suggestions about what's going on there, but I think that mine makes some sense, if not the most sense. Yes, right. There would be a little more, shall we say, reserve and propriety. The question is when the kind of refrain, which is in 8:4 and in other places in chapter 2, I ask you, O daughters of Jerusalem, do not arouse or awaken love until she or it pleases. Very difficult for the pronoun there to be translated. Could be very neuter or generic. Well, what is the role of that repeated refrain? And I think that the role of the repeated refrain is the appeal to love itself personified, to remain quiet until it is stirred properly. And therefore, it's almost like the chorus being the voice of that personification. In Greek drama, you have a chorus, so to speak, off the stage of the drama, but supplying some of the narrative context. I'm suggesting that that's what's going on here. Again, I'm not dogmatic about that, but I think that this repeated refrain is an attempt to personify love in a kind of choral pattern, where they're singing that you must wait for love to awaken itself in its own time. The question is the lover's triangle interpretation of the Song of Solomon and how it has it was popular and has been reprised more recently. It was actually most popular in the 19th century in Victorian England. It became the subject of church plays, church dramas, to the point in which people were writing plays for performance in church settings in which you had a love triangle of this wealthy royal Solomonic figure, this shepherdess, this kind of rustic girl, lowly and peasant class, who is carried away by Solomon on his white charger, so to speak, and leaves the shepherd lover behind whom she had grown up with. And of course, in Victorian circles, that had great romantic sale power. You know, you could get your Harlequins of the day with that one. Well, it came back into critical discussions in the early part of the 20th century, and it still rumbles around. And my response to it is there's absolutely not one scintilla of evidence from within the Hebrew text itself that there is a third competitive figure in this drama. There is a man and a woman as there were in the garden. There weren't three in the Garden of Eden, except if you want to consider the tempter, but that's not part of the love diagram that exists between God making man and bringing her to woman. Therefore, if my rooting Song of Solomon protologically is accurate, we can't have another individual cluttering up the landscape. I don't think you've got this kind of sappy love story where some rich and famous guy takes this girl off to the palace and leaves the poor, helpless, rustic lover behind. No, there's nothing in the text that suggests another male person in the dialogue. The comment was in 8, 11, and 12, that Solomon has his vineyards, which are worth thousands, and she is reserving herself for Solomon alone. I think in the light of the antithesis or the contrast within the rest of the poem, we're moving towards this kind of climactic statement that in terms of the abundance that Solomon does have and all the riches that he possesses, she is the singular delight and possession of his love. And she sees herself at the end of the narrative, at the end of this love development in that way. She is perfectly secure and entirely content even in the face of anything else out there that may compete with her, namely all of his riches and wealth. So therefore, I think we're coming to, shall we say, a climactic crescendo at the end. We're not moving from here back to try to redefine the relationship from chapter 1 on. Let's take 8, 9, and 10, where the brothers who have been named in verse 1 are brought back into the scene as they were in chapter 1, having sent her into the vineyard. So the brothers become a character in the epilogue as they were in the prologue. And the gist of what they are saying in verse 8 and 9 is that they are going to wall her up or close her off. They are going to kind of keep her away because she's not mature enough for love yet. We have a little sister and she has no breasts. That is an indication of her immaturity. But you will notice how she responds to that in verse 10. She is not to be walled up or sealed in. She is a wall and her breasts are like towers. She is indicating that she is fully confident and mature and ripe in her love and love giving. And so it's her response in antithetical fashion to the demeaning way in which her brothers see her. They see her in the prologue as only one who's good enough to take care of the vines after they go away and leave her. And here they see her as one who is not really mature enough to be an object or a giver of love. She is responding in both cases in terms of her own assurance, particularly here, mature assurance, chapter 1, where she leans upon him to reciprocate that confidence and assurance. So this is the image of maturity again, ripening love in 8, 9, and 10. Possible. I haven't actually thought about it. Is 5, 8, and 9 a flashback to her youth? It is a possibility. I won't deny the suggestions. Is it her love eternally planned? Is the suggestion from 5, 6, and 7? My problem is 5 itself. The one that is leaning upon the beloved is the female figure. So I believe that 5, that 8, 5, defining her leaning upon the beloved means that she is the one that is talking from that point on. I won't deny the possibility of flashback to youth there in verses 8 through 9. But as I've said throughout the weekend, I'm not infallible in my interpretation, so don't please take that. If this stimulates you to other reflections, by all means, you're at liberty to make those observations. Touché. A very good point. I have to deal with that, and I can't right now. But you are lining up the female figure in both places, and that's excellent parallelism. I would. I think it's, again, this kind of journaling, telescoping, flashback technique where she looks at the whole relationship, or he looks at the whole relationship as it has occurred from beginning to end. So I think that runs throughout the poem. That pattern of flashback technique where they're looking all the way backwards and forwards is present all throughout. There is familiarity, but I don't think it's sexual familiarity between the wedding, because even though they refer to it or reflect on it, they're reflecting on it from after the standpoint of the wedding. As a flashback technique, in drama or film or narrative in general. Where a movie will start in the middle of things and you get part of the story and then you'll get a flashback technique which sums you up to that point. They don't have the right to derive that or deduce that from what I'm saying. Because I'm anchoring this book in the standard, Christian morality of chastity before marriage. And I think that this book fits into that pattern in general. And therefore, that's the way I read it. I don't read it as an exception to that or as a license for someone to go out and do differently. No, I think it'd be a misreading of the book to use this as an excuse for premarital sexuality. If I need to make that any stronger, I will. That's right. I apologize. I skipped addressing that because I got carried away with the other explanation. I believe that it is the female again, and it is an appeal to those who are around her that they would hear what she hears, that she wants to hear the voice of her beloved, and that when she hears it, he would hurry to her, even as they would, shall speak, confirm or respond to the fact that she's appealing for the hearing of his voice, and if they hear it, that, so to speak, they would pass that on to her, I think. But I admit, verse 13 is difficult. But my whole case doesn't collapse if I can't answer verse 13. I don't think. Well, thank you very much for your attention, and I trust that you will be continually blessed as you reflect upon the Song of Solomon. Perhaps this is the beginning of a journey for you in a wonderful book, but not the final answer, but a suggestion of answers that will lead you to even better answers than we've received in the last 2 days. Thank you very much.